You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, Jay Cutler.
Cutler straight drop, steps up in the pocket.
Caught for a touchdown.
Uncut with Jay Cutler. We've got a pretty cool guest, Mark Cuban.
Thanks for having me on.
Did you know that you wanted to get into business?
From the time I was 10, 11 years old, I was always hustling. I want to party like a rock star the rest of my life and just have fun.
Yeah,
exactly.
If you do it right.
Yeah, and even if you do it half wrong.
Yeah, you're probably more than half. You can still be fine. Uncut with Jay Cutler, Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Jonathan Charks of The Ringer, and as is often the case when the two of us record a podcast, we go in a lot of different directions here. We start in Sacramento with the coaching change that happened over the weekend, and then get into a lot of our most interesting topics so far going on in the league. Phoenix, their strong start. Portland, and a lot of other kind of situations, what we're ruminating on, what we're marinating on, the teams that have changed our perception, and plenty more. One note at the outset, there were a few volume issues on this podcast. I think it'll square up when I've been checking it. It looks like it'll square up in the final version of the mix, but I wanted to let you know, and that might lead to a few words being clipped just because the detection software worked a little bit wonkily. So apologies for that, but it still should be strong, and the content, of course, is absolutely there. So just wanted to note that at the outset, but it should be good. Here you go. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We should probably start this with the topic that you wrote about this Monday morning at The Ringer, and that is the Sacramento Kings, who made the decision, I believe that was on Sunday, to fire Luke Walton. And I think you focused in on something that makes a lot of sense as kind of the next decision point for Monty McNair in this front office, which is, what are you building around? Like, what is the foundation, both personnel-wise and kind of philosophically? And, you know, Alvin Gentry as the interim coach might be a part of that answer, but we honestly, that's like the biggest question that Monty McNair still has to work with.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's kind of the thing we always, like, everyone knows this, but I feel like it's always important to, like, boil it down. Whenever you take over a job, like, how do you define a GM? I think, like, ultimately a GM is defined by who his best player is and what his plan for that player is. And if those are the fundamental points of emphasis. And if you don't have, everything else flows from that. So an example of that would be Gerson Rosoda. Okay, he had a plan. His plan was, Karl Towns is my guy. I'm going to turn him into a jump shooting, three-point shooting center and build from there. Now, we can get into, like, the weeds of that plan, how it was executed. And obviously, with Roses, there's many other things going on. But fundamentally, as a GM, you have to have a plan for your best player. And so I'm looking at the Kings. They just fired their coach. And I think at this point, Luke Walton, I have no, like, really strong opinions about him, which is probably a bad thing after 6 years. He's kind of a coach, right? It's like he's pretty generic. And it really comes down to, is De'Aaron Fox your best player? And if he's your best player, what is your plan for him? And at this point, it doesn't seem clear what the plan for Fox is. Well, I think especially when he drafted Davion Mitchell. But I get I think Haliburton and Fox could work together. But once you add Mitchell, it's like, okay, your plan is to put more point guards around your point guard and have a small all team. And I think in a sense, they almost depowered De'Aaron Fox by drafting him. And that was kind of what my piece was about. You look at De'Aaron Fox's stats this year. At this point, I think it's more than just a shooting slump. And I'm thinking De'Aaron Fox is no longer the player he was last year because of the players you have around him. And it doesn't seem very sustainable to me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit to the overall thesis there. And another important consideration I always deal with in these sorts of circumstances is, what is this person's connection to the person who's making decisions now? So Luke Walton was inherited by Monty McNair. So that meant Monty McNair didn't choose his coach, kept him on. That might have been financial. That might have been he wanted to see what Luke Walton could do. There are a lot of different reasons that could or could not have happened. And De'Aaron Fox is a little bit different because of the contract extension. I believe McNair was the one who negotiated that. Though with max contract extensions, I often think of those as more ownership decisions rather than general manager mm-hmm. decisions, because that's just the nature of how much money you're expending. And so it'd be interesting to kind of find, that's generally never going to be public information, but if you could parse it. And doing the autopsy to it, in a sense, on the Walton regime, I mean, a part of the story is that the Kings haven't defended. They were dead last year. They're currently 24th in cleaning the glasses iteration of the stat. And it's also bizarre because Walton's teams previously generally had done a pretty decent job defending, like in the trouble in Sacramento. And I try to index a team's defensive performance based on their defensive personnel. And I would say Sacramento overall well below average. I like Rashawn Holmes, but he's not the best defensive center. And generally speaking, they played small, limited, or both players at a lot of the other positions. There are exceptions, including Davion Mitchell, but that's still hard to overcome. That said, I think the biggest question here is De'Aaron Fox. And I like to start it with a basic one, which is the whole point, to an extent, of having a point guard who is your primary ball handler, is that the idea that when they're in the game, they can generate good shots for themselves and others. And converting those shots, sometimes that's not their problem. You know, like if you have bad shooters on your team, well, if they're setting up good shots and the guys aren't hitting them, that's not necessarily your creator's fault. But I've been lower on Fox, generally speaking. There have been some strong stretches in there. Like the part of him that I've always really liked is that he can push in transition, he can make teams uncomfortable that way. But the question of whether he can be the force driving a successful half-court offense, I'm still a little bit skeptical there. And now we're getting into, this is Fox's age 24 season, still plenty of improvement that he can make, but the less likely that answer is a yes, the harder it is to make him the focal point.
Yeah, so I'm looking at it now. Why did they fire Dave Jurger? Was that because of the Bagley thing? It's been so long, I've kind of forgotten. Is that why he lost the power struggle about Bagley, basically?
I'm trying to, I don't remember exactly. I wish I did. Yeah. I think it might have been a power struggle. I know that happened with Mike Malone. Or I remember that happened with Mike Malone back when that happened. So yeah, with Dave Jaeger, it might have been that. I can't remember for sure. And also, Vlade Divac had a personal relationship with Luke Walton, so I think it might have been a circumstance where it was more of a replacement rather than a firing in a decision in and of itself, and then a separate replacement. It might have been, hey, I'd rather have this guy as the coach rather than the person we have right now.
Because the reason I asked is because it felt like that the last year of Jurger, that was the best season they had with Fox. And you could see Jurger's plan. Like, we're going to run pure spread pick and roll. They had Cauley-Stein, the elites at the four. They pushed the ball constantly. And I think if De'Aaron Fox is your best player, that's how you have to play, is get him out and take advantage of his speed. And I think, to go back to your question about De'Aaron Fox in the half court, I think he's a smart enough player that ultimately, when he's in his prime in 4 or 5 years, I think he could operate within a half-court setting with other ball handlers. I think that will happen for him, but I don't think that's where he is now. And I think putting him in that kind of context now is setting him up to fail, which is basically what's happened this season.
Yeah, and it's fair to argue, and I would as well, that, you know, De'Aaron Fox shooting 24% from three, and importantly, 48% from two. Like, that's a real struggle as well. And
three was average, 2-point numbers that are, like, concerning you, I think.
Yeah, exactly. After he'd been more in the, like, 53-54% range over the last couple of years. And I'm glad that you brought up the last year under Jaeger, because that's one of the stats that I really like. Clean the Glass has a version of this, which is the percentage of plays that you do in the half court. And so I bring this up a lot this year with the Toronto Raptors, but Sacramento is another excellent example of this. There are kind of two different ways that you can do this. So one is, you know, no matter what, you want to have the best half court offense you can. But another way to create a more efficient offense is to spend less time in the half court, because basically every team is more efficient in transition. It's easier, the defense isn't set, everything else. And so that last year under Dave Jaeger, and you could argue, and I would, that this is unsustainable. When Fox was on the court, the Kings played fewer than 75% of their possessions in the half court, 74.4%. That is incredibly low. Like, that is one of the highest marks, or lowest, depending on which way you see it, I've ever seen. And then they've hovered around 79-80. So that's 5% of all the possessions when Fox is on the floor that are now in the half court. And so that can lead to some of it. And you're right, that was basically the identity of that 18-19 Kings team. And whether it was because that was unsustainable, or whether it's because they changed to a coach who didn't have that as like his fundamental ethos, that isn't the case anymore.
Yeah, and to me, I think sometimes, which we can get into, like, how good is Fox actually? I think it's an interesting conversation. I think for Sacramento, the better question is, if we're not building around De'Aaron Fox, then who are we building around? And I guess the answer to me then would become Tyrese Halliburton. And I kind of think once they drafted Mitchell, it feels like the Fox ended. Maybe they didn't ultimately realize it at the time, but I just don't see a world where you can have Mitchell and Fox together. And then once you draft Mitchell, you really can't trade him and get any value. So to me, either they're going to punt Davey on Mitchell and waste the pick, and that's their guy that drafted, or they're going to move Fox. I think that's like the pressure point.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, to tie it back to that Suns team that had three point guards, it doesn't necessarily, like, you can do that as a form of optionality of, hey, we don't know who's going to be the best of this group. Then it was Bledsoe, Dragic, and Isaiah Thomas, if memory serves. But what you are doing to some extent is putting the writing on the wall that, hey, at least one of you is going to be gone at some point soon. And that's a lot of pressure. And maybe that's pressure that is weighing on each of those gentlemen differently. And I really like Tyrese Halliburton. I thought he was horrendously underdrafted. My biggest criticism of him was that I didn't know if he could be that guy, you know, the player who can generate those good looks. But what I liked so much about Halliburton is that he can plug the gaps basically with a lot of other things. And you know, guy in his early 20s, you're not going to close the door that he can never be that guy. It's just, it wasn't he didn't have the same pop in that phase of the game that somebody like Trae Young or Luka Doncic did. And, you know, those guys were drafted high. Those guys are damn good players. But with Davion Mitchell, it's not the same problem, because he's a very different player than Halliburton. And I wonder that, to me, each of those guys is better suited being like a secondary ball handler and play finisher and everything else like that. The challenge there is, okay, if I end up being right, and there's no guarantee that I am, then you need to get that from someone else. And if it's not De'Aaron Fox, then it's somebody that's not on the roster right now. And Sacramento could be bad enough this year to have the opportunity to draft that player, but that would take a while. And they also don't have a ton of financial flexibility to, you know, like they'd have to probably do a trade rather than signing somebody through free agency to get that, because they have Fox and Hield and a lot of money on their books. So I'm really interested if, let's say, Monty McNair sees this the way that you and I are interpreting that he does, that it's, you know, we're moving to more of a focus on Mitchell and Halliburton, both of whom he drafted. That, first of all, then it's like, okay, well, what are you going to do with Fox? But then it's also, is his expectation that one of those two guys is going to be the engine? Or is his expectation that they can find it in someone else?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure what the answer is. I do think a Halliburton-Mitchell backcourt, I think, possibly could balance each other out pretty well. And kind of like what you're saying, what makes Halliburton so fun is he's like, he can really balance out anyone. He really is a close, whatever the gap you have to fill with your backcourt partner, he can kind of fill it. So I can see how a Mitchell Halliburton backcourt could fit together. But I think it's a fair question. If those guys can those guys really be the engine of a offense? I'm not sure.
One. And so I think,
and in the piece itself I wrote, I don't know if I really emphasized this enough, is I wouldn't have drafted Mitchell. I would have run with Fox and built around him. But I think now that they've drafted Mitchell, that ship has kind of sailed, and they've got to make the best of it. So I don't even know if trading Fox is the best idea for the franchise, but I almost feel like they have to do it at this point because trading Mitchell's not going to happen. And then once you decide that, you almost have to trade Fox because there's no other way to upgrade your roster, and you're kind of stuck in place. And then the question becomes, what can you trade Fox for? And I think that's a fascinating question, too, because I'm not really sure what his value is around the league. For a lot of the same things we're talking about, that he kind of needs to be the man. He needs a team built around him. And who really wants to do that? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a similar problem, but to a smaller degree, is the one that the Sixers are dealing with Ben Simmons, which is also the teams that might be interested in Fox probably don't have the things that will actually help Sacramento in the immediate. Maybe you can do something with matching salary and future draft picks. And yeah, I mean, Sacramento is at a very different place than the 76ers are, where that is significantly more palatable for them than a team with Joel Embiid that's thinking their window is now or now-ish. And for, I mean, Fox, this is the other challenge, and you know, I've long held the stance that teams should be a little bit more reluctant to give out max extensions to players who haven't established that they're worth it. And unfortunately, for very different reasons, the Michael Porter Jr. situation may cause some movement that direction as well. And with Fox, that's the other part of this, which again parallels the Ben Simmons thing, which is it's so much easier to move off of even a very good player when they're not on significant long-term money. Because now, not only do you need a team to like De'Aaron Fox, you need them to be able to match salary, and you need them to not have the sticker shock that after this season, they will owe De'Aaron Fox $135 million over 4 years. And is it possible that there is, you know, you brought up Gerson Rosas before, is it possible that there is a Gerson Rosas out there that saw D'Angelo Russell's contract and went, yeah, that's fine. Of course, totally possible. But like you were saying, I don't know who that team is. And it's possible that Sacramento, if they can hold on long enough, that from what Sam Vecenia said, and I'm sure your colleague Kevin O'Connor is probably saying the same thing, is that this is a very weak point guard draft. And so maybe a team that has identified point guard as a long-term need says, well, Fox is better than we can do, and we're buying low, because if the Kings are selling soon, they're selling low. Maybe there's a path forward there, but that's probably not right. It's probably not this trade deadline, and that's going to create some awkwardness if I'm right.
So, yeah, I was kind of
thinking it out, like, who would make sense? So I think if you look at rebuilding teams who need a point guard, the one that jumped out to me was Houston.
Uh-huh.
I think they drafted Jalen Green not to be the point guard. I think they drafted Jalen Green to be, like, a Beal, Levine, Booker type.
And obviously they benched John Wall to experiment with Kevin Porter at the position.
And I think Porter has talent, but I'm not sure running point is really where his future is in the NBA. So the trade I thought of first was Christian Wood for Fox. And I thought, I don't know salary-wise, but that's the two components of the trade. That makes...
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I'm a fan of Christian Wood. I'd be interested in how Gentry or whoever the next coach is after that would manage the Wood-Holmes dynamic. Something else that could be a possibility if they're really selling low, if the idea is more that the Kings are scared of the long-term money, would be something involving Eric Gordon probably as the matching salary, and then one or more of the Rockets' higher profile, like rookie scale guys. So they have these four rookie scale contracts right now. Jalen Green's not going to be included in anything like that, but Şengün, Garuba, Josh Christopher. Yeah, maybe one of them gets involved in the trade. Maybe Kevin Porter Jr. if the Rockets are lower on him than it sounded like they were at the start of the season. And then the other question that I've been dealing with Houston for a long time is, what do they want to do with these more veteran players? Gordon fits this too, but he has a bigger contract, who make sense on the Rockets because if your goal is to be competitive, but they aren't necessarily on the right timeline, and that would be Jayshon Tate and Daniel House. Both of those players would actually be good fits on the Kings, more as sweeteners in a deal, and there are other ways Houston could do that. You know, they could be trying to trade those guys to contenders, and House is on an expiring contract. But I think there might be fertile ground there if the salary matching can be there. And then the other huge challenge with the kind of two younger teams trading with each other is, can they evaluate each other's talent closely enough to make a trade that is agreeable?
Well, that goes back to, I don't know, like in baseball they call it the challenge trade. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
I love the idea of challenge trades, and I think NBA teams should do them more often. I think, like, looking back on it, the Sixers probably 2 years ago should have challenge traded someone, Ben Simmons. Once they had Butler and said, this team is Butler and Embiid, we've got to get Simmons out of here to deal with these two guys. I'd love to see more of those kinds of trades. The problem, of course, with a challenge trade is, like, the risk is so high. You could look very, very foolish if it turns out poorly, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But I do think it makes sense for teams in terms of, once we have, it all goes back to, like, hey, once I have my top guy, if my number two guy doesn't really stick with my top guy, at some point there's going to be a clash. And we're going to have to break these two up. It happens all the time. I think NBA teams should be more proactive about that and really build teams to fit together in terms of their young core. So I'd love to see it. But, yeah, as you said, it's hard to know if that's going to happen. You don't see it very often. I do think with the Kings and the Rockets, one thing that would help is McNair was a Houston guy. And you can never discount the power of relationships with these kind of things, right?
That's a great, I'd forgotten about that. That's a really good call. Yeah, and I mean, Rafael Stone was there. I don't know this off the cuff, but I would believe that they have a working relationship.
You would assume so, because he didn't just, like, lure from the lawyer side.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I'll give you the choice. There are a lot of other things going on in the league. What is interesting you the most at this juncture?
Ooh, that's a good question. There's so much going on. It's hard to know what. I think, I guess, my big question is, give me like 2 seconds. Let me look at what do I want to talk about?
I think
Portland's really interesting. I'm not sure what,
right? It does feel like they're kind of, in terms of like bigger dog out, they're kind of like, Portland's kind of an upscale Sacramento in a lot of ways, right? With a bunch of smaller guards, you know, they hit a ceiling, they just fired their coach. Their GM may not be, I guess with Portland, all
depends on Olshay, right? It does feel like, I don't know much about that, but it feels, it's a weird situation. Like, are they trying to push him out? I don't.
So my theory of it, and this ties in with some of the reporting that exists on the general managers potentially forming some sort of professional association/union, is that Portland might be trying to get out of this for cause, meaning that they don't have to pay Olshay. And I mean, that's a huge financial thing if they could pull it off. I'm not sure that they can. I don't know the specifics of the circumstance. But part of the reason for me why Portland is such a significant situation league-wide is typically, like, you have these audience of one situations where, you know, a single person's decision making, whether it's rational or irrational, is the only thing that matters. And typically in the NBA, that's an owner. You know, that's the, okay, they're the ones who make a lot of these decisions. Even though you have a general manager, it's the owner that, like, if it's a star level trade, the owner has to green light it. And I mean, the reporting that's out there about Russell Westbrook going to Ted Leonsis is a good reminder of that. But in Portland, the audience of one is Damian Lillard. And with Lillard, it gets into this fundamental question of, what does he want for the next 3 to 4 years? And there isn't a right or wrong answer there. It's just, as long as he's true to himself. And so if Lillard wants to stay in Portland, that has been everything that he's said publicly over time, and he wants to see what they can do, more power to him. Fully support it. But in my opinion, and this might be becoming his opinion, you're not going to be relevant for title contention there. And yes, it's true that the Portland Trailblazers did make the Western Conference Finals once, but they made one of the easier roads to the Conference Finals in modern history, and then got waxed by a still injured Warriors team. Now, the Warriors were talented, but they still got waxed. So it's like, is there a path? And there isn't a path for me for Portland to change that fate, because they're simultaneously too good to get, like, a game-changing young guy, and they're also not good enough to have it be, like, a small internal improvement, and they don't have the financial flexibility to do, let's say, what Phoenix did, and maybe we'll talk about the Suns in a beat. But so for Lillard, like, if his thing is, like, hey, I want to, like, at some point in my career, I want to be on a team that has a chance to at least, you know, make some noise and be in contention. He's 31 now. Like, he can do that too. But my big question is, we have no, like, I mean, basically everything Lillard has said publicly is that he wants to stay in Portland, and he could be that way for the rest of his career. That'd be great. But If that changes, when that changes, in the league calendar is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting to compare him to Bradley Beal. And I think they've been clumped together for a while now because those have been the two targets for Philly. And I think the difference is basically Beal is getting his game time now. I think every elite player at some point in their career wants to be, and it's like they should be a piece of a team. The team should be built around them. They should explore the limits of their game and kind of have that like 3 to 4 year window where they're the main guy. Everything goes through them. The franchise revolves around them and they get to push their limits as a player. I think Beal was not in Dame's position because this is really the first season where Beal's getting that opportunity because he was drafted behind John Wall. It was Wall from that whole decade, basically. And then Russ came in and obviously pretty much whatever team Russ is on, it becomes Russ P. So that's just who Russ is, right? So now those two guys are gone and now Beal gets his own team. And I don't think Beal was thinking, I've got to win a title next season. He's pretty much explicitly said that. I think that only happens after you've been the guy for a long time. And then it's like, what's next? I think if you're the guy for a long time and you win a ring in your city like Dirk and Kobe, it's like, you know what? I've won my ring. I'm the guy. I'm very comfortable. I can play out the rest of my career here and set up my post-career life and it's all good. But I think if you're the guy who don't win, eventually it becomes, okay, what's the next thing as my career wraps up is going for a ring. I think, for example, that's kind of like Chris Bosh. It's almost like, you know, you kind of have to have your young man phase where you're like, sow your oats, kind of. I think as a player, that's important too. But I think now Dame has done that. So my expectation is at some point in the next year or two, he's going to decide, I've done all I can do here. I want a new challenge. It's not going to, there's no way to go from A to B at this spot. And I do expect at some point, I think it's fair to assume he will leave eventually. And then you're right. It's all about his timetable. But when he decides has so many dominoes for the rest of the league, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, that's it's a great point. And it's in some ways hard to discuss because it's depends on an individual person's judgment. And we only have limited public comments to assess it. But I think you're right on the money in terms of what his thought process could be at some point in the future. One other, I understand why, especially when you consider their relevance and star power, that, you know, the Lakers' troubles have been very prominent. But the Phoenix Suns have not lost a game in the month of November. And we are currently recording this on November 22nd. And there is a possibility, I would say definitely not a probability, considering they'd have to beat both the Nets and the Warriors, that the Suns win every game in the month of November. And that is an incredible story when you consider that they, you know, just made the NBA Finals last year.
Yeah, I mean, they've been great. I want to give a shout-out to Frank Kaminsky. That was amazing when he had, like, 30 points in that game.
Yeah.
That was really cool to see Frank the Tank. Because, oh, yeah, by the way, I was the best player in the Final Four 1 year. And I think he's hurt now. He's a third-string center. But that was cool. Like, even the end of their bench, it's just so well put together, this team, that you can be out. Really, they're out their top. They were out, like, their top three centers because Dario Saric's not all season. And they're like, you know, here's our four-string center. Let's just put him in, he'll score 30 points and beat the Blazers by himself, basically. That was awesome. And I think Suns-Warriors, that's going to be like one of the early games of the year. Like, it really does feel like those two teams have a separate West half. Yeah, and Phoenix is just, it's year two with Chris Paul. And it's just like, it's one of those things where it's just so rare when all of your best players can be the best version of themselves together. And, like, no one is kind of eating off each other's plate. And, like, we're seeing the best version of Chris Paul. I mean, he's a little older now. He's not the best version. But the best version is the best of Devin Booker, the best version of Mikal Bridges. And, like, the only thing we were worried about was DeAndre Ayton and his contract. And he seems to have, which props to him, that he's really integrated himself on the team and not kind of derailed things, which is a really big concern, given that he should have been paid this summer or he wasn't. But, yeah, like, he has a whole two-way team. Like, and when you have those things going together, you can roll a lot of bad NBA teams really fast.
Right. And there, it's fair to mention that the Suns have had some very positive luck here. Like, they've faced a lot of weak opponents, and some of the stronger opponents that they faced have been without their best players. Like, they beat Dallas twice. Luka didn't play in either of those games. They beat Denver, and Jokic didn't play in that game. So, yeah, you made it easier. But especially when it's beating everybody. And as you mentioned, some of the, a portion of that stretch, four or five games, if memory serves, were without Ayton, who's one of their better players. And the Suns also, I think that the Suns, you know, winning, I believe it now it's 12 games in a row, and doing so at a time when, you know, preliminarily, the top of the West doesn't look as strong as it was. And part of the reason why many, including me, discounted Phoenix's chances of repeating as Western Conference champions was the idea that they were a very good team, but they benefited from a lot of relative health, where they were, you know, they probably would have lost to the Lakers if Anthony Davis hadn't gotten hurt again. And then they had health-related benefits against their other opposition too, including Denver with Jamal Murray being out and everything else. And so it was the idea that, well, they were the best, they were the healthiest, and they were the best of the weak crop. And the Warriors are their own thing, and they've also had some weaker opposition. But the Lakers' struggles, the uncertainty with Kawhi, the uncertainty with Jamal Murray, like I think that even without the win streak, the Suns being the team that they were puts them in a pretty good position.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, oh, they beat teams with injury risks, and it's true they did. But all that's kind of like you said, all those teams still have injury concerns, right?
Right.
Like Clippers, Nuggets, Lakers, they're all still injured. And who knows where those guys are going to be cold. I think, too, when they buy back, Clippers will be back to be the Clippers. But it's a little more complicated than that because getting Kawhi back means everybody else changes their role, right? And that can be done, but that takes time to reintegrate guys into their new roles. And we'll see if Kawhi can be Kawhi right away. So it's hard to know what those teams are going to be in 6 months, whereas we know what the Suns will be if they're healthy. And I think what's interesting about them, too, if you saw Phoenix, really ended up being playoff, basically they were at their worst when somebody had a big man who could beat up Ayton, right? Anthony Davis, where he got, and then obviously Giannis in the finals. But there's no one like that in the West besides Anthony Davis who can really outplay DeAndre Ayton. That's what kind of makes some Warriors really interesting. And I'm not exactly sure how that would go. I think ultimately I would take Steph Hall. That's a game where like both those teams seem to be matched up pretty evenly. And it should be a really fun game, I think, right after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it is. It is right after Thanksgiving. Should be a ton of fun. And it will also be difficult. I mean, so the part of the fun there is that the Suns had this run last year and the Warriors were down. And when the Warriors were up for their run, the Suns weren't really around either. So there is some individual experience, and the teams do play in the same division, so they have some regular season stuff. But there'll be a lot of players that are thrown into a very different situation there. And that also brings a fascinating question, which is how do these coaches want to handle those matchups? So for Steve Kerr, that's who do you want to put on Booker? Who do you want to put on CP? But also, what is your concept? Do you want to go to a switch heavy system and something you're going to have them find some mismatches? And then for the Suns, are you going to have Mikal Bridges lock and trail Steph Curry? Maybe, probably, but are they going to go to a different approach? And so we're going to learn a lot about Monty Williams because both of these teams are unusual tactical challenges. And so we'll get to see how the coaches respond to that.
I'm curious, as a Warrior, someone's been on the Warriors a lot, I've always had the sense that Steph and Chris Paul, like Steph beating Chris Paul. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Back to the Clippers-Warriors days?
It is.
Kind of some tension
and
there.
I don't know that it's there's personal tension there, but I think the idea that when Steph was kind of coming up, Chris Paul was the biggest point guard on the block, and not biggest in terms of stature, obviously, but he was the best point guard sized player in the NBA when Steph was coming up, and so I'm sure he relishes that. And the Warriors and Clippers were rivals for a few years there, so there was a little bit of extra relish on that. I don't know of any personal animosity between those two. Steph doesn't really have that with too many people. Chris Paul does. That's just the nature of him, and I love Chris Paul. It's just part of who he is,
for sure.
And but I don't think there's any like secret tunnel stuff between those two guys.
Like Steph played Chris Paul in the Clippers. He played Chris Paul in the Rockets.
Right.
It's almost like Chris Paul is like endlessly searching to find somebody to beat the Warriors with.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I hadn't pieced all of that together, but you're right. Yeah, if it happens, if they get to like a playoff series, it'd be the third different uniform. Because yeah, Paul and the Hornets Pels didn't ever the Warriors weren't good enough then to be relevant. And yeah, I mean, so the Suns are, I think, just an absolutely fascinating, important story. And the other kind of element that I deal with a lot in the early part of a season is, what of the teams that are having, you know, having a little bit of a stumble? What of that is real and what of that is temporary? And so that could be in terms of, like, I think it's easiest in a circumstance like the Bucks, where it's like, oh, a bunch of your best players are out at the same time. Sure. Like, there is a reason to believe that the full strength Bucks, or close to full strength, will be the full strength Bucks. Like, that's just the way it can go. But I'm really interested in Dallas, who Dallas is over 500, but they also are being outscored overall using Clean the Glasses net rating. I did a whole podcast with Caitlin Cooper about Indiana, which I think is interesting. The New York starting fives issues are potentially significant. And so it's just it's such a pivotal time in the season. Now, it's not a good time for making broad pronouncements because we're so early. But this isn't the time for people to freak out, and except for very specific circumstances, but that time is coming pretty soon.
Yeah, and it's always injuries, right? Yembe's season is so long. It's like, it's easy to forget that when you're in the kind of the weeds of it, and it's like, what's happening tonight, what's happening tomorrow? But it's like, they still got 6 more months. Is it 6 more months for the playoffs? I mean, 5, right? That's a long time. And then, like with Dallas, Luka goes, they had a really easy schedule start of the year to kind of stumble along, beat a bunch of bad teams. And right when they start playing good teams, Luka goes down, which means I feel like I live in Dallas and the Mavs a bunch, and I still don't have a great feel for them. Because I remember thinking, okay, they're going to play the Suns twice and the Clippers twice. We're really going to see that Luka goes down. Kind of like, what do these games even mean? Who knows? They're playing a whole different style of Luka on the floor. It's hard to say. Yeah, and injuries kind of like can clarify or kind of cloud it even more. I look at like Atlanta and Boston. They both started off stumbling out of games. And I love DeAndre Hunter, but it does almost feel like without him out there, it's like all the other guys have more room to breathe because they almost had too many play. They had my boss, Bill Simmons, he called it the too many guys problem. And it felt like the Hawks had too many guys problem. And then one injury almost like made it easier for them. It kind of clarified roles for everybody else. But Hunter's coming back eventually, and we'll see what they end up doing.
Yeah, that is significant. And the Hawks had that long losing streak, and then they've had a winning streak after that, including beating some of the injured teams we were just talking about. But yeah, I mean, and you also run into this challenge with a lot of them of it's the idea of, okay, confirmation bias or, you know, leaning on your priors. And oftentimes that's a smart thing to do. You know, like for example, the Bucks, where it's like, okay, we can use context here. Yes, they're barely over 500, but there's something that we know. But then there are also circumstances, and I would say that the pre-injury-riddled Cavs were one of these, where I had to reevaluate my prior. And basically, I thought they were going to be worse defensively than they were, and they were just a capable defensive team. And the offense was hit or miss, depending on the game. And it's such a difficult balancing act that I think is also part of what makes our job so fun, is trying to figure out, is this real or is this temporary?
Yeah, I think there's enough time now. Like, at this point, I'm pretty sure Chicago and Washington are good teams. Chicago is special. Like, that's what I was saying. And then it's like, okay, once you know what a team is, and all of a sudden one injury can just change what a team is. And sometimes we don't realize how valuable a player is going to be till he's out. You bring up the Bucks. One thing I am kind of curious about is this whole Brook Lopez thing. It's been like oddly under-talked about because there were so many injuries. But a guy his size at his age has a mysterious back injury, kept him out, tired him. I do wonder about that. Like, when are we going to see him again? And when we do, what's he going to look like? Because obviously, that's kind of it. There's no going back from that. Like, no pun intended.
Well, and it's not only that, but it's how the reliability becomes a huge question. So it's true that one of the options is to play Giannis more at center, but then you need the rest of your roster to make sense with that concept, which I would say losing PJ Tucker hurts that. You know, are you going to play Grayson Allen and DiVincenzo together when DiVincenzo comes back? Another weird injury that we have heard basically nothing on for a while now. And that is a real concern because when a team, and almost every NBA team, this isn't a Bucks-specific criticism, it's basically every team that has existed. When a team needs basically all of their key guys to be healthy in order to be dangerous, to be their most dangerous, then everybody's health matters. And the Bucks do not have a Brook Lopez replacement, and unfortunately his twin brother is playing somewhere else. Maybe at some point his twin brother would have a buyout and potentially go, and not that Robin is as good as Brook, but that could be, because one of the weirdest parts for the Bucks is they can't, I'm not even saying like run a discount version of Brook, it's that the only other rim protector that I trust on their roster is their starting power forward, which is a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to kind of bring it all the way back around, you're talking about reliability, and that's what makes Porzingis such a difficult thing for the Mavs, is because Porzingis needs a very specific ecosystem around work, but then you can never count on him. So you built this whole thing to accommodate him, but he's just out randomly for like 5 games of back tightness. And now you got to get a whole new setup going in. And then it's like, okay, now we have to change the whole system up for guys in and out of the lineup all the time. It makes it very, very difficult to get any consistency. And I think, like, and this goes back to the whole, like, you got to find one player to build around. So, like, for the Pacers don't have that one player to really build around, which means they need all of their guys to be healthy at the same time. But that's just difficult, right? Like, they've been waiting on TJ Warren for almost 2 years now. And when you have no star and no, like, easy roles for everybody else to line up in, that means you're going to have 5 or 6 guys all in their prime, all healthy, rolling up. And, like, Indiana's been the last 2 years, someone's always hurt. Well, the reality is someone probably is always going to be hurt in the NBA. Like, people don't understand, it's not the NFL, but it's plenty physical. It's a long season. These guys get beat up. Someone's in the regular season. So it's very hard when you don't have one guy and role players around him, but you have 5 decent players for to be consistent.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. And it's also, we talk a lot about how stars are irreplaceable, but especially if it's wings, important starters can also be really difficult to replace. And that's, you know, I think we're seeing that with TJ Warren in Indiana. We're seeing that kind of around the league. And then, you know, like if you can build a deep enough roster where you can kind of fill some gaps, and then that's, you know, going back to the Suns, that's some impressive thing for them about playing those games without Ayton. But yeah, it's, I'm so excited to see where this next month or so goes, because, you know, what of these teams that have kind of stumbled to start the season, as you put it, like Boston and Atlanta, which of them can make their way back into the conversation, and then which of them just kind of get defined by the stumble? And that happens, and it's the reminder that, you know, we're not playing in a simulation, and just because a team has a lot of talent, that doesn't always guarantee that it works out. And sometimes a team that doesn't have a ton of talent, it does work out. Like, the duality of that, it's more prevalent over a 10-game section of a season, but it can be over a full season as well.
Yeah, and I think it's fun to see the East, for once, be deeper and more competitive. Like, we waited, what, like 20 years for this to happen?
Basically, yeah.
But it finally happened. The worm has finally turned. And you look at the East standing, and I would say the only teams who, if they miss the play-in game, are like, it's all good, is Detroit and Orlando. So there's 13 teams for 10 spots. And it's kind of hard to, the one thing about the play-in games, it's kind of hard to lie to yourself about where you are if you finish 12th, right? Like, okay, we're not very good.
Yeah, like, oh, we were so close to making it into, we were so close to making it into the thing where we'd have an outside chance of making it into the actual playoffs.
Yeah, right? And so, okay, if we're not even going to make the top 10 seed, it's time to reevaluate where we are. And that's the other part of it, too. I think, like, Indiana, and I'm really bummed for Toronto. I think that's another team where I wonder if the shoe is going to drop. I'm really, really curious to see what OG Pascal Barnes looks like. And if that doesn't work, it says Pascal. I think Pascal actually becomes the odd man out there out of OG and Barnes. And then that becomes a big domino. It's like, I think Pascal Siakam on the right team, we saw him in 4, how valuable he could be as not the primary guy. That becomes on play now. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really fun. Anything else you want to discuss? We're right about at time.
Okay, let's talk about Mavs real quick. Like, okay. What's your big picture sense from the outside about Luka and KP? Is this going to work? Do they got to break it up? Where do you land on that?
If the goal is to be a consistent championship contender, I don't trust Porzingis enough. I don't think he's good enough as a player, but also, as you brought up, the reliability to be that guy. I think some of Luka's struggles to start the season, those are small sample size, those are anomalous. I believe in him as a player. And we'll see how the kid stuff works out. I'm very cognizant of the defensive philosophy and the shots that you're taking and everything else like that. But if I had to make a decision right now, I don't think Porzingis if we're talking about the full thing in terms of his skill set, his availability, and everything else, I don't think he can be the second best player in a title team unless everything goes right.
Yeah, that's kind of where most people in Dallas have lined up on. But then it goes like, where would you trade him? Who would even want him?
Well, and what's the Dallas has tried a couple of times now. Like, how in the world do you get another number two? Like, they tried to, you know, tried to get Kyle Lowry in free agency. He spurned them to go other places. Ostensibly were keeping cap space open. Maybe they're interested in Giannis. Like, Getting number ones is really difficult. Getting number twos is also really difficult.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I think that, like, I'm really excited about with Charlotte. I've always been in those two pieces together. I feel like Dallas, I don't know the number two for what's going to look like, who that's going to be. It's a pretty good question. We'll see what Nico Harrison thinks and what he's going to do, because I have no idea at this point.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's fair. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Jonathan Charks for taking time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Ringer, and you can also, of course, follow him on Twitter at Jonathan Charks, JonathanTjarks. Love talking with him, and special connection, of course, for those of us with long ties to Real GM. Jonathan and I have known each other for a long time now, and I've been such a big fan of his work since we worked together, and it's so much fun to talk with him whenever we get the chance. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choosing. You can also help other people find the show by word of mouth. But the single most important thing you can do is subscribe and download every episode. Whatever podcast player you use, whether it's Spotify, Apple, wherever you want to go, subscribing really helps because it'll just pop in your inbox. And Real GM Radio will never come out on a specific day of the week. There's no pattern to get into. It's just when it comes in. So subscribing, it comes in there for you and helps us out a lot too, of course. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On Prime, still going strong. Nate and I recording 5 days a week, actually technically two public episodes, and then the rest of it is on Dunked On Prime. If you want to do total access, there's a great Discord community there as well. You can also check out my written work at The Athletic. I have a bunch of things in the works right now, some collaborative, some solo, and those should be coming out probably after the holiday. I'm guessing we'll have a little bit of a quiet time now going around Thanksgiving. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise, and I will try to respond, but I don't guarantee that, but I do promise that I will read it. I do that every day. And since this is the week of Thanksgiving, at least for the American listeners among this group, I wanted to appreciate not only, of course, all of you for listening, but also everybody who helps make this show a possibility, everyone who helps make Real GM Radio and everything else I do my life's work is really fantastic. And that's the people at Podcast One, of course, Real GM, especially Chris Reyna, who has been one of my biggest supporters, also one of my best bosses for over a decade now, which is truly incredible. And everybody at both of those entities for doing the work that it takes to make a podcast great. And of course, everybody that I deal with professionally, but in many ways, most importantly, you, the listeners, because that's how this is possible. Having enough people who are interested makes it so that we can keep this thing going. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.
A healthy lifestyle depends on quality sleep, and Sleep Number is here to help you sleep more efficiently. Sleep efficiency is the amount of restful sleep you have at night and is a key part of your overall health. Here are some tips to help you get the most efficient sleep possible. Reduce caffeine consumption before noon and limit late night alcohol. Get regular exercise during the day, which helps you feel tired in the evening, and keep track of your sleep health with data from your Sleep Number 360 smart bed. Sleepers who routinely use their Sleep Number 360 smart bed features get almost 100 hours more proven quality sleep per year. year. With that much extra energy, you could get more quality family time, volunteer at a meaningful charity, or exercise, meditate, and reconnect with nature. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep, which starts with Sleep Number adjustability. It's time for Sleep Number's ultimate Sleep Number event. Save 50% on the Sleep Number 360 Limited Edition Smart Bed, plus special financing for a limited time. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com/podcast1. Subject to credit approval, minimum monthly payments required. See sleepnumber.com/podcast1 for details.